Let's get this second hour rolling like we do every Tuesday afternoon as we welcome back to the program author and critic, man about town, Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
How are you, my friend?
I'm doing well. Yourself?
Okay.
We want to talk today about Stranger Things, and I know I said I would get caught up, and I started to, but we had issues last week with power outages and storms, so I didn't get through all of Season 2, so if you hear me going la 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 at times, it's just because I want to avoid any potential spoilers.
And here I was picturing you with a big bowl of Reese's Pieces having yourself a Netflix marathon.
No. Well, I started it.
That was me.
All right.
Carrie did that. He took care of that.
Oh, well, he made it. You were the one with the truncated verse. Okay, we'll
yes.
work around that.
So let's go back to the genesis of this last year when the Duffer Brothers took the world by storm. What was it about Season 1 of Stranger Things that made it connect so much with viewers?
I think part of it is the parcel it comes in, really. The whole notion of sitting there in our instant gratification age and you can just zoom your way through this in whatever, I think it's, what, 8 episodes in the first season, and boom, there you are. You're done in, what, less than 10 hours. So I think that's part of it. But also, with the first season in particular, it was the ensemble. I think it was the relationships between the characters, even more than the horror element, that is what did a lot of the selling for that program. Because you think about all the things you like, all the films you like, and TV shows you like, even if it's like The Walking Dead, it's like the zombies and something like that, they're kind of set dressing. What we ultimately, fundamentally come back to all the time are people talking to each other. We lean a little more forward in our seats to hear what they're saying, how their relationships are evolving or devolving. And I think that first season nailed that while having this horror element that, yeah, it could frighten you. And it was also kind of this nice nostalgic throwback to the 1980s. But I think it was more than that, because you couldn't have these characters exist, I don't believe, in the here and now. It would be a completely different show. So the real time period you had to venture back to would have been the 1980s. And then you can reference all sorts of slasher films and John Carpenter films and things that you don't have to be like a cineast, like a movie expert, to be familiar with and go, oh, yeah, I know that one.
Well, it was great, too, and obviously it's fun to watch Winona Ryder being on edge every moment she's on screen, but for me, we talked about it last year, it was the young actors, the kids, who were so believable in their roles.
Yes, and I think that's something that is a drawback to Season 2, although it sort of affirms something that happens in life. As we go along, innocence becomes lost, and our little enclave that we have when we're younger, our group, you know, our core that we ride our friends that we ride our huffies with, it breaks up. And you see that in this second season, but I think it becomes too padded, the show, when we lose a lot of those relationships. Like you get Mike and Will, they're together sometimes, but Lucas and Dustin become more of a duo. You don't really have the four interacting again to the degree that you do in the first season or anything close to it. I think that's a definite drawback because, yes, it is that ensemble, those four young actors that are the heart, certainly, of the show.
And that's what I hearken back to when I watched it last year, and you talked about the Carpenter films, the horror movies. I also thought of things like The Goonies and E.T., but for me, even though it was a different time period, I kept flashing back to watching Stand By Me.
The E.T. one, especially in the first season, right? Because your bike as a kid, I don't know if it's really the same way now, but there was a certain time, your bike was your transformative, imaginative agent to a different world of your own making that was proportional to your own given capacity for wonder. So I think there was a heavy, like, E.T. element. Stand By Me is kind of like that, too, right? I mean, it's a travel film
yeah.
in some ways. Like, even though they're going whatever they're going, 10 miles into the woods, but those 10 miles might as well be, like, the 10,000 miles we do as we lose our innocence. We go further along. We drop our illusions. We learn things about our friends, and learning things about our friends, oftentimes, and this is the same thing if you're an adult, you learn about yourself. And I think that's what that film is about. That's what this show is about, to a certain extent, and you just overlay the horror vibe on top of that. Think about, like, the soundtrack, too, is so evocative. It's like, you go back to Psycho, you go back to Jaws, you go back to Carpenter's Halloween. When you have, like, one or two note patterns in horror films, they're really effective. And you see that throughout Stranger Things, too, that kind of electronic rumble, right? Like, this synthesizer type of thing. And sometimes it's a red herring, like you hear it and you think, oh, no, and it just turns out that they wore costumes to school when no one else did. But it's like that red herring, that kind of intertextuality that you get with 80s films that this is playing off of. There's like a cleverness, a nod to say, okay, this might mean this, but we might be referencing this, and it probably means something altogether else that you're going to learn about shortly.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown. Season 2 of Stranger Things also brings a couple new talented veteran actors into the cast with Sean Astin and Paul Reiser. What did you think about their addition?
I thought Reiser was really good in particular because when he comes on screen, he can go either way. And he's really good at conveying that. I mean, if you've seen My Two Dads, you know how edgy I'm just kidding. But you don't know if he's like sinister at first. And he's also kind of avuncular, and it plays out the way it plays out. Sean Astin character, I thought he was interesting, especially as a foil for Winona Ryder's character, because here she is, the single parent, right, who has a child with her who's gone through something, well, traumatic doesn't even cover it, right? Something beyond preternaturally macabre. And he's almost like a father figure for the boy's mother because you get the sense that she's not in his league, but she's looking for a calming influence, and it seems almost like an asexual type of relationship, a relationship of convenience to bring some stability back to the family where he's almost playing a part, and he just wants to settle down, and I think he conveys that really well. I mean, he says he doesn't want to play roles where he's the friend, but he is good at being the friend. You know, I mean, of course, like there was the star turn in Goonies, but it was Goonies. There really wasn't a star of Goonies. You were like a Goonie. So wasn't exactly a hero role.
So what were the things that didn't work for you so well in season two?
Well, there was the padding that came with, I think, dividing up the kids. But Mike, the Mike character, he's sort of the driver of the first season. He's almost like Jack is on Lost, where you're going to see the story through his eyes. And I don't think that really changes in the second season, but it's much more of a limited vision. And he's kind of become less fully drawn in the writing as a character. He's querulous, he's complaining, he doesn't seem as developed as someone like Dustin, who I think works really well in season two, almost like he's come into his own. Then you have Max, good character, but then you have her brother, the kind of like 80s, like the guy from, like, was it Rocky III, who was like the bad guy?
Yes.
You pump like Scorpions music and like, oh yeah, here we come, like a hurricane. This is going to be great. And he's just kind of there to be like 80s stock footage guy. I don't really see what role he has. He doesn't inform anything about Max's character. He doesn't bring anything to the group dynamic of like the kids. He kind of has like that basketball moment with Steve Harrington where it's like a coaching moment where he leans over him and he says, set your feet and take a charge. And you think, oh, okay, this bad guy is going to come in later and save the day. But then they just kind of like, eh, we don't need to revisit him. Just get him out of here. We don't need to look at him in our mix. And then the whole Chicago sequence, I thought, where Eleven goes to Chicago for like a road trip. It's like, you know how like when bands have a first album and they've had these songs their entire life or their whole like music writing life. And then you get to the second album and it's like, kind of the stuff we had left over that didn't make it onto the first album, right? And then you see if the third album is going to be that Hard Day's Night kind of moment, and oftentimes it's not, and the band is done. I feel like that's kind of what this second season was.
You know, a couple of things, but well, I'll start with what your last point. That episode, to me, felt like something that they used to do a lot in the 80s. The spinoff episode, where they'd have the characters from the TV show, you know, introduce somebody, and then the next 90% of the show was these characters who were next season were going to have a new show if there was a good fan reaction to these characters.
Mrs. Garrett, Mrs. Garrett was leaving Different Strokes.
Right.
She got her own brood. Yeah, it was, and I don't think that was kind of one of these clever homage kind of moods. I mean, the thing with the 80s setup is it allows you to be a little tongue-in-cheek, but I don't think they want to cement the story in the 1980s. It has to be set in the 1980s, because if you think about it, when can you ride your bike around after dark? When can you? I was on my run this morning, for instance, and I'm going past the bus stop in Charlestown, and all these people milling around outside. There wasn't a one of them who was not looking down at their palm where their phone was.
Right.
Like,
right.
I just don't think we cogitate imaginatively like we used to. You kind of have this clay of feet era for the various Ozymandiases out there right now. So if you had these kids behaving that way in this day and age, it would be because of poor parenting, or that they were prodigies, right? These geniuses that just had to buck sort of societal trends. And also, I think that just informs how we think. We're less apt to look inside ourselves to create narratives. It's almost like a sense of play. You know, even like adults who always retain a sense of play, of invention, they're making up little games, just whatever to get through their days and enliven them. And that's what those four kids do. And, of course, it doesn't work out so well in that something that they couldn't imagine ends up happening. But I think, like, that's why, even though these guys, I think they're only in their early 30s, it's like you'd have to set it in the 80s or before. You couldn't do it in any time since.
Yeah, I mean, and also, if you move it another decade ahead, and some of the problems that they have are solved by a cell phone. You can call and, hey, watch out for, you know, what's coming, or is the investigation and the communication that drives the plot is gone with technology developing any further than it is in that show.
Sure. I imagine you could write out some of the technology. Like, you could have a kind of technological shutdown because of the manifestation of whatever is happening and the upside down bleeding into this world. But that would be almost a little cumbersome. But again, it's just that idea of, I don't think we do this anymore. And it's not just like an indictment of like parenting, but I don't think we do this at any age really anymore. And I think that's part of the reason why we are in the slop that we're in at the moment, that you need to either literally or metaphorically go out and scrape your knee and bleed a little bit. Mm. That's just how you live. And that is what this series really encapsulates in so many ways. And I think that's why there's such a bond between these young people. As you go along in life, the bonds change or whatever. And you find in the second season that for the first time, these kids are starting to lie to each other.
Mm.
And, you know, anyone who's gone like to middle school knows that, like, well, you know, there's a lot of that going on. There'll be even more in high school. And then life, as you proceed, becomes just, well, how much of the truth am I going to say here, unfortunately? And with everyone playing a part like that, we become more and more disconnected. So I think there's a lot we can learn from young people like this, even when they're fictitious characters.
Yeah, and that's why I think why I go back to that line at the end of Stand By Me when the narrator says, I never again had friends like I had when I was 12. And to me, that's the essence of that show, is that bond between the four. And as it begins to not be quite as strong in season two, even in the episodes I've seen, that's where it loses a bit of the appeal. It's still great, but not quite what it was last year.
I think that we can have bonds that are every bit as deep and as intense as the ones we have in childhood, more so, because we're more ostensibly fully rounded when we're adults. But you don't know when you're a kid that you are risking vulnerability, that you are really putting yourself out there when you open yourself up to one of your peers. And as adults, there's a fear factor with that. And people, I mean, how many people do you know? They have social media. And on social media, all they do is tell you how wondrously glorious their life is and just bathed in nonstop happiness. And yet, we're more alone than ever. We're more disconnected than ever. We're often more mentally ill and more depressed than ever. And people long for connection, but they're scared to sort of leap across that chasm. And I just think when you're a kid, it's easier. So that's what you want to do. You want to retain that capacity for wonder, that ability to play, to take a risk, to ride your bike late at night after you've maybe stayed out, you know, past dark, which at this time happened about an hour ago.
Colin Fleming on Stranger Things Season 2 with us. And next Tuesday afternoon, we'll talk about a man near and dear to the state of Maine, his classic, The Maine Woods, and it is the 200th anniversary of the birth of Henry David Thoreau.
Everyone loves Walden, and everyone, maybe not everyone, but a lot of people know about his writings on Cape Cod and certainly his writings from Maine, but I think a lot of people tend not to know his wonderful journal entries, and people like to slag off Thoreau as someone humorless. He's one of those things that's supposed to be bad right now. I know most things are, but he's definitely one of them. But if you read his journals, you can find that Thoreau was one mirthful, okay, maybe not mirthful, but he could be pretty humorous. He's a humorous guy.
The lighter side of Henry David Thoreau next week right here. Thank you, Colin.
All right, thanks.
We'll see you then. Colin Fleming with us every Tuesday on Downtown.